picture this. You are stepping into like a dimly lit, incredibly sleek metallurgy lab.
Oh, I can picture it.
Right. And the walls around you are superimposed with these glowing, just continuously shifting thermodynamic equations.
Mm-hmm.
And right in the center of the room, there is this massive projection of a live feed from a confocal laser scanning microscope.
Which is such a cool piece of tech.
It really is. And, you know, you look at an I-beam on a construction site or the chassis of your car, and you probably think of it as just permanent.
Right, like it's a finished product.
Exactly, a finished sculpture.
Yeah.
But if you heat that metal up, microscopically, it's just this chaotic, shifting war zone of atoms.
It really is. It's the absolute definition of a dynamic living architecture.
Yeah.
And the way those atoms decide to organize themselves in that war zone, I mean, that changes everything about how that metal behaves in the real world when you actually go to use it.
Exactly. And that invisible microscopic drama is what we are getting into today. So welcome to this deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we're unpacking the microscopic mechanisms of how steel transforms. Specifically, we're looking at the lengthening kinetics of something called Widmann-Stettin ferroplates.
Right.
And to guide us, we have a really fantastic pair of sources to dig through for you.
Yes, we do. We are looking at a 2026 scientific paper by a team of researchers, Arya, Nabil, Zurab, and Fillion.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually managed to measure this microscopic growth. But we are pairing that data with a newly published, incredibly detailed commentary by the renowned material scientist HKDH Padacia.
Which is just a gold mine of context.
Absolutely.
So our mission for you today is to understand how scientists actually managed to measure the invisible growth of metals. We're going to figure out why the mathematical models we've relied on for decades to predict that growth often clash violently with physical reality.
Yeah, that's the big one.
Right. And why one expert is advocating to completely throw out a long-held scientific assumption. Padacia actually explicitly recoupled in his notes that he is highly complimentary of the original research by Arya and the team.
It's a beautiful example of how science is supposed to work. I mean, it's a polite, rigorous scientific debate.
Right.
He respects the data they gathered, but he is fundamentally challenging the theoretical lens through which some of that data is traditionally viewed.
So let's start with the searing heat and the microscopic chase.
Yeah.
Because before we can talk about what these researchers found, we have to establish how they actually looked at the metal.
Exactly.
Because obviously this isn't exactly something you can just eyeball.
No, definitely not.
I was looking at the specs for the steel they used in this experiment. It's mostly iron, of course.
Yeah.
But it's got this very specific, delicate dusting of other elements, right?
It does, yeah. It's an iron alloy, and it contains exactly 0.12% carbon.
Okay.
When it's 0.018% silicon and 2.07% manganese by weight.
Okay, so they take this very specific piece of steel, and they austenitize it at a blistering 1,200 degrees Celsius.
Which is incredibly hot.
Right. And then they subject it to continuous cooling at a rate of 3 Kelvin per second. And the paper mentions the calculated AE3 temperature is 796 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to stop you there, because what does calculated AE3 temperature actually mean for this metal?
That's a crucial threshold, actually. So at 1,200 degrees Celsius, the steel is glowing blindingly hot. At that temperature, the atoms are happily settled into a specific crystalline arrangement called austenite.
Okay.
But as you cool it down, and that 3 Kelvin per second is a very deliberate, steady cooling rate, the material becomes unstable.
Oh, I see.
The AE3 temperature, so that's 796 degrees Celsius, is the theoretical point where that austenite structure can no longer hold itself together in equilibrium.
It just falls apart.
Well, the material desperately wants to transform into a different structure called ferrite. It just really wants to rearrange its atoms.
Got it. And to watch this rearrangement happen, they used that wild piece of technology I mentioned earlier, right?
Yeah.
The confocal laser scanning microscope.
Yes.
And it has a resolution of 1.3 micrometers. But the paper says it tracks, and I quote, transformation-induced invariant plane strain displacements.
Right.
What on earth does that look like in plain English?
I know. It is a very dense way of saying it measures the physical bulging and shifting of the metal surface.
Oh, okay. Bulging.
Yeah. Think of it like this. As these Widmann-Stettin ferrite plates grow inside the solid metal, they actually distort the surface, almost like a tiny mole burrowing just under the grass of a lawn.
Okay, that makes sense.
The laser microscope is just mapping those tiny surface distortions, those bulges, in real time.
I can picture that. Okay, let's unpack this. we now have these incredibly precise measurements of how fast these microscopic plates of ferrite are lengthening. But how did the researchers actually try to calculate or model that growth rate mathematically? The paper brings up this framework called Trivedi's theory fitted by Hilliard.
Yes, a classic.
Before we even look at the numbers, what is that math actually trying to solve?
Well, in simple terms, Trivedi's theory is a mathematical way to describe how a curved point, like the tip of a growing needle or plate, advances into a surrounding material.
Okay.
It basically calculates the speed of that tip based on how quickly atoms can get out of its way.
Okay, so to run that calculation, the equation looks at a few key variables. There's supersaturation, a weighted average carbon diffusion coefficient, an assumed interfacial energy of 0.2 joules per square meter, and the critical plate tip radius.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to assume that the plate automatically adopts a tip radius that allows it to maximize its growth rate.
Right. And what's truly fascinating here is how the experimental data perfectly aligns with something called periequilibrium estimates.
What are those?
This is a concept that was actually proven mathematically and experimentally back in 1981 by Padacia himself, among others.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And because the new data in this 2026 paper agrees so beautifully with the periequilibrium model, the authors implicitly rejected the idea of a mythical barrier to interfacial motion.
And Padacia is thrilled about this. I mean, he literally says he's pleased the idea has been rejected.
He is very happy about it.
But I need you to break this down for me. What is this mythical barrier, and what exactly is periequilibrium?
So, to understand periequilibrium, Padacia brings up a brilliant quote from a scientist named Christian, written all the way back in 1965.
Okay.
Think of the steel as an interstitial solid solution. You basically have two types of components.
Right.
You have the large, heavy atoms, the iron and the manganese, forming the main scaffolding or lattice. And then you have the tiny carbon atoms, which fit into the little gaps, the interstices, between the large atoms.
So it's like a giant scaffolding made of heavy bowling balls, with tiny marbles slipping through the empty gaps between them.
Yes, that's exactly it. Now, at the temperature where this transformation happens, one component, the little marbles, the carbon, is highly mobile. It can easily diffuse and travel long distances through the metal.
Okay.
But the other component, the heavy bowling balls, the iron and manganese, is totally sluggish. It is completely immobile.
Wow, okay.
So the periequilibrium model says the whole transformation consists of the carbon rapidly diffusing out of the way, combined with the iron and manganese simply snapping into a new architectural arrangement without actually traveling anywhere.
Snapping.
Yeah, that snapping is called the Martensitic type transformation.
So it's a displacive transformation. The heavy atoms just shift their shape like a geometric toy collapsing into a new pattern while the carbon runs away.
Exactly.
And this mythical barrier they rejected. That was this old idea that something was physically dragging or slowing down this snapping interface, holding it back from moving as fast as the carbon diffusion would allow.
Right, some invisible friction.
But this new data shows, nope, there is no friction. There is no barrier. It moves exactly as fast as the carbon can get out of the way.
Correct. The data in the paper is brilliantly explained by this carbon diffusion controlled displacive transformation. The periequilibrium model just works perfectly.
But wait, if Padacia and this new data are proving that the periequilibrium model works perfectly, why has the scientific community been arguing about this for decades?
That is a great question.
Like, what is the alternate theory they've been clinging to all this time?
So the competing theory is called the NPLE condition, which stands for negligible partitioning local equilibrium.
Okay, NPLE.
Right. This was proposed by Coates in 1973. Now, NPLE assumes that during this transformation, even the heavy sluggish elements like manganese must maintain perfect equilibrium at the growing interface.
Okay.
And to maintain that specific chemical equilibrium, the manganese has to diffuse. It has to actually move out of the way, not just snap into a new shape.
Wait, hold on. If the confocal laser microscope relies on capturing displacive transformations, meaning it's literally mapping the surface bulges caused by the heavy atoms rapidly snapping into a new lattice, How could a mathematical model require a sluggish element like manganese to physically diffuse out of the way? Doesn't that directly contradict what the microscope is actually seeing?
It does.
Because if the manganese had time to diffuse, it wouldn't bulge the surface in that rapid displacive way.
That is precisely the contradiction. You've hit on the very core of Padacia's main critique.
Wow.
Yeah, the original 2026 paper compared their data against NPLE calculations, but they left out a massive, glaring detail.
What was it?
the width of the concentration spike of manganese that the NPLE model actually requires.
Wait, why on earth did they leave it out?
Because if you actually sit down and calculate the width of that required manganese spike, the math breaks down in the real world.
Really?
Yeah. As Padeshia points out, a gradient energy term makes such a transformation physically impossible.
I need to pause you there. Gradient energy term. What does that actually mean for physical reality?
It basically means nature hates steep cliffs.
Okay.
The NPLE model requires a spike of manganese at the interface that is so infinitesimally narrow, so impossibly sharp, that the laws of thermodynamics simply won't allow it.
Oh, wow.
It would require near infinite energy to maintain a gradient that steep without the atoms just naturally bleeding over into the surrounding area.
So the math requires a physical impossibility just to function.
Yes. And furthermore, in all the decades since 1973, there has been zero experimental evidence ever produced to show that this concentration spike of manganese actually exists.
None.
Nobody has ever seen it because thermodynamically, it likely just can't exist.
This raises an important question, though. Why keep using a model that demands an invisible, impossible spike?
That is Padeshia's exact conclusion. He states very strongly that if the widths of these substitutional solute spikes aren't physically meaningful, the NPLE concept is best abandoned entirely.
Just throw it out.
Yeah. It's a theoretical artifact. It's phantom math that doesn't match the physical reality of the metal you are looking at.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We've talked about the models they used, but we also have to look at how the researchers handled their own data.
We do.
Because Padeshia points out a subtle but, like, massive complication in how the experimental data was charted on their graph.
Yes. Moving from theoretical models to experimental realities, there is a fundamental issue with the plotting.
Right. So the experiment, as we established, used continuous cooling. They dropped the temperature at a steady 3 Kelvin per second.
Mm-hmm.
That is an anisothermal process.
Mm-hmm.
But when they plotted the lengthening rates of these ferrite flakes on a graph against temperature, they plotted them using average values, treating the data as if the experiment were isothermal.
Right.
As if the temperature had been held perfectly constant at different intervals.
And physically, you just cannot do that. You can't simulate non-isothermal growth as a series of stepped, steady-state isothermal phases. It simply doesn't work that way.
I'm trying to picture this. Why can't you just take the average? It's like driving a car. Right? If I'm driving where the speed limit, the incline of the road, and the wind resistance are all changing every single second,
right,
I can't try to calculate my exact momentary fuel efficiency using only the average speed over the whole trip.
That's a good start, but it goes deeper than that because of something called lagging solute.
Lagging solute.
Yeah. The mathematical growth solution assumes a steady state, but in continuous cooling, that steady state is constantly being disrupted by shifting boundary conditions.
Meaning when the temperature drops.
When the temperature drops, the local equilibrium solute concentrations shift. And when they shift, the supersaturation changes and the concentration gradients driving the growth change.
Okay.
To build on your vehicle analogy, imagine you are driving a massive snowplow.
Okay, I'm with you.
As you push forward, you build a massive pile of snow right in front of your bumper. In our metal, that snow is the carbon profile diffusing away from the growing plate. If you suddenly hit a colder patch and your engine slows down, so the temperature drops, that massive pile of snow doesn't just instantly vanish.
Oh, right.
It is still sitting right there in front of your bumper.
It's carrying baggage from the higher temperature.
Exactly. The solute profile in the matrix simply cannot keep up with the shifting interface concentration. That original pile of snow will actually reduce your ability to move forward in the next step.
Wow.
Because of this sluggish solute baggage, anisothermal growth, so continuous cooling growth, will always be slower than an isothermal growth experiment conducted at that exact same lower temperature.
And Padeshia even includes a video reference in his commentary to prove this, doesn't he?
He does.
He notes that if you look at the growth curves, the anisothermal growth, which is the blue curve in his example, is measurably slower than the isothermal growth, the red curve, at the exact same temperature.
Exactly.
So by plotting continuous cooling data as if it were a series of isothermal averages, you are misrepresenting the physics of what is actually happening in the metal. You're pretending the snow pile just vanishes.
It's a critical flaw in the data presentation, even if the laser microscope data itself was beautifully captured.
Which brings us to one final glaring mathematical contradiction that Padeshia highlights in the commentary. And this circles back to the MPLE model we talked about earlier.
Yep.
It's about capillarity.
Ah, yes. the Gibbs-Thompson correction.
Right. So the commentary brings up capillarity next, but I have to admit, I'm a bit confused here. When I hear capillarity, I think of water climbing up a paper towel or like surface tension.
Sure.
What does that have to do with microscopic steel plates?
Well, in metallurgy, capillarity deals with the surface energy at curved interfaces. The tip of this growing ferrite plate isn't perfectly flat, right? It's a tight curve.
Okay.
Think about the atoms sitting right on the point of that curve. Compared to atoms on a flat surface, they have fewer neighboring atoms to bond with.
Makes sense.
Because they are more exposed, they are more energetic, more jittery, they are much more eager to dissolve or move. That extra energy fundamentally changes the local equilibrium at the tip.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. The curved tip changes the energy dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, you said there is a really strange inconsistency in how researchers apply this.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the NPLE model, as we established earlier, forces both carbon and manganese to diffuse.
Right. The marbles and the bowling balls both have to move.
Exactly. Now, when applying this model to plate growth, researchers strangely allow for the capillarity correction, the Gibbs-Thompson effect, for the carbon atoms.
Okay.
They account for how the curved tip affects the carbon's energy, but they oddly completely ignore the capillarity correction for the manganese.
But hold on. If NPLE says both of them are diffusing, and their fluxes, their movement rates, must be strictly linked to maintain that local equilibrium at the interface.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just apply the laws of physics to one element and ignore the other.
You absolutely cannot, since their fluxes are inextricably linked in the NPLE mathematical framework. The capillarity effect on the manganese should mathematically influence the carbon concentration at the plate tip, too. You just cannot isolate them.
So it's mathematically inconsistent.
Highly inconsistent. Padeci admits he isn't entirely sure how mathematically significant this specific capillarity effect will be on the final lengthening numbers, but he insists that it absolutely must be established.
Yeah.
If anyone in the metallurgy community is going to keep insisting on applying the NPLE model to curved interfaces like these plate tips, they have to do the full math. They can't cherry pick which elements obey capillarity.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
Yeah.
We started out looking at an incredibly precise experiment using lasers to watch microscopic steel plates grow.
We did.
But the real lesson here isn't just about steel. It's about the rigor of science itself.
It is entirely about ensuring your theoretical models actually reflect reality.
Exactly. Whether you are prepping for a boardroom presentation, building a financial forecast, or mapping the thermodynamics of a metal alloy, your theoretical assumptions have to match your physical, observable reality.
Right.
You can't rely on a model like NPLE that demands an impossible, invisible concentration spike of manganese just because the math looked elegant in 1973.
No.
And you certainly can't plot dynamic, continuously changing data as simple averages and expect the math to work perfectly.
It requires a constant, vigilant questioning of our own underlying assumptions.
And that leads to a really profound thought. We talked at the very beginning about how we look at solid steel and assume it's static, unchanged, a finished piece of architecture.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath, it's a dynamic war zone.
Padecia showed us today that a mythical barrier to that dynamic growth has been accepted in metallurgy for decades, complicating the math and muddying the waters for absolutely no reason. It makes you wonder, in your own field of work, whatever it is you do, what mythical barriers or missing spikes are you currently accepting as fact? Simply because the prevailing models and the old textbooks tell you they should be there.
What an incredible question to leave on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We hope this look into the microscopic war zone of steel inspires you to keep questioning the data and the models around you. Until next time.